Good afternoon, and welcome to Who the People Radio. This is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
I sound like I have a wool hat pulled down over my head.
Oh, there we go. Well, she just broke
and
the...
I broke something.
She's breaking stuff.
All right, I've only been here 30 seconds and I broke something.
Yeah, so what are we doing today?
Oh, hey, listen to that. I can hear you now.
Yeah.
Well, we're hearing from you about our sponsor.
Yes.
Less than 25 seconds ago, you reminded me to let you do that part.
Hit
it, Bill!
I am kind of like the faux engineer on this thing, you know.
You are.
Yeah. Hey, so our sponsor today is Pape Machinery, and Pape Machinery is our brand new John Deere Ag and Turf dealer here in the Redding area. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. And they do everything John Deere as far as ag and turf. So if you want a lawn tractor, a zero-turn mower, you want a compact tractor, all the way up to the 5000 series tractor.
How do you mow your whole grass if it's a zero-turn mower?
Oh, because it spins on itself. I mean, you don't need any room at all to turn those around.
You can go straight.
You can go fast, too.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Very speedy. But, yeah, go by and see the folks there at Pape Machinery. Their phone number is 226-9226, and you can get them on the web at papemachinery.com. So go talk to the guys over there. They've got some big inventory right now, so now's the time to go upgrade your machines.
Yeah, but you're just talking about tractors. We live in California. What would be the most important thing people might need?
It's when you come into California, you buy a home, the first thing you do, you know, a lot of people, first thing they do is they go buy a lawnmower or, you know, whatever. In California, you buy a generator. It's very important that you have a generator because here in California, we don't have electricity that we can count on. It's going to get shut off for long periods of time. So go buy Pape Machinery and buy yourself a generator. They got lots on hand, everything from 1,000-watt to 10,000-watt generators, from little portable units to units that will run your whole house.
Do you get a discount if you cry in the lobby?
No, but it is permitted if you want to cry because they're out of a
particular
model. Yeah, you can cry in the lobby, and that's okay.
However... doesn't turn into those tears do not become cash.
No,
darn it,
they do not translate into any sort of discount. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, just thought I'd check.
Pape Machinery.
All right.
Yeah, there we go.
She wants us to talk louder. Wow. Okay. I'm 58 years old. No one has ever asked me to talk louder.
No. You have been called Ethel Merman at times, but
shut up. That was just my neighbors.
Mammy.
You've got a voice like Ethel Merman. It's like, oh, thanks for that. You could tell I was old. I actually knew who she was.
Yeah.
Okay. So do we have Dr. Pry on? So that, you know, because obviously our part of the program's over. Oh, but our guest today is very, very timely. He's always timely, but this time he's more timely than usual. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is the Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and Director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. God, having a little problem wrapping my lips around that. Both congressional advisory boards, and he served on the EMP Commission and the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, House Armed Services Committee, and the CIA. He's the author of Apocalypse Unknown, The Struggle to Protect America from an Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe and Electric Armageddon. So you can experience Electric Armageddon just like California, or you can read about it in the book. And then figure out how we're going to avoid that, because I got to tell you, all joking aside, it isn't pretty.
No.
I mean, it isn't pretty.
No, we're the test pattern for that.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, come to California during a blackout and
And Dr. Pry has written
happens.
An article called California Wildfires, Object Lesson for National Grid Security. And we thought, gee, what a timely article.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure if it's actually officially been published. So if you'd like to read it, it's at wethepeopleradio.us. Kind of forgot to give you that part. And an archive of this program will be posted free for your use after the show goes up. So anyway, there's no reason not to share this with a friend. Dr. Pry?
Yes.
I didn't even send you a note. I didn't even send you a note about daylight savings because I'm like, he'll know.
Of course he'll know.
We've gotten busted on it a couple times, but I figured you would know.
Well, I did know.
Of course
and
you did.
The article will be published in the Washington Times in the newspaper tomorrow. It might be online today. I'm not sure.
Oh, cool.
It's it's co-authored with my boss on the EMP Commission, Dr. William Graham, who had been Ronald Reagan's science advisor, and another one of my previous bosses and good friends, Jim Woolsey, Ambassador Jim Woolsey, who was the director of the CIA. And one might be wondering about what do California wildfires and the rolling blackouts have to do with national security? Obviously, the people who are enduring this and going through this in California understand what it has to do with their personal security and their state and the security within their state. But it seems to me, with all the coverage that this has been getting in the press and in the newspapers, nobody has drawn the obvious conclusions about what this has the larger implications for national security.
No, that's a great point. I'm glad we're talking about that, because nobody has mentioned that.
Well, actually, I mean, a lot of people have figured out that since the world has sort of moved away from landlines, that if they don't have cell service, they don't have any personal security. If they have a medical event, I mean, they're on their own.
Mm-hmm. But we do smoke signals in California. We're getting really good at that.
Yeah, the problem is they're so big you can't read them. So what made you? I'm sure you've been watching this for a while, and I'm not sure really where you want to start on this. But we've got 3 minutes till our first break. So why don't you have at it and give folks kind of an overview of what we're going to be doing today?
Let me give the implications it has for national security is that California has become an object lesson. And the fact that the way the U.S. government plans to protect our national electric grid and our other life-sustaining critical infrastructures won't work, because that plan that the Department of Energy and the Department of Homeland Security are responsible for implementing depends upon working with and partnering with and trusting the electric utilities and the regulatory agencies in the U.S. government, like the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and North American Electric Reliability Corporation, and that obviously doesn't work.
No.
You know, these people, it hasn't worked in California for such simple and obvious public safety measures as making sure power line towers are not so old and decrepit that they won't be toppled in high winds. And it doesn't work because of vegetation management is a very obvious, common-sense thing.
Make sure
that the power lines are not going to be downed by an old tree that falls on them, and they're not even competent to do that. So how do we expect the utilities and their regulatory agencies to perform when it comes to much more complicated and much larger existential threats to the United States, like EMP and cyber warfare? They can't be trusted to do it. The EMP Commission, on which I served for 17 years, in their report warned that they can't be trusted to do it, and the proof of that is available for all to see on television every evening in terms of what's going on in California right now.
Yeah, and it also shows, the after effect when they don't do their job. Here we are, hundreds of thousands of people without power for days and days, and the aftermath of that.
Yes, well, the consequences in California are relatively minor compared to what would happen
with
a natural EMP or a nuclear EMP effect. We only have 3 minutes, so I thought I'd just give a quick overview.
Oh, but then but we have the, tons of time after that.
Yeah, but the main threats we're worried about, are not power lines down by wildfires, but something like an EMP that could kill 90% of the American people through starvation, disease, and societal collapse if the electric grid is not adequately protected. Do you want to trust these bozos to protect the grid against something like EMP or cyber warfare when they can't even do their jobs on vegetation management and basic safety precautions that are just common sense things that anybody should be able to see, but they're too corrupt and too greedy to even do that? And it's not just the utilities that are to blame, but later we can get into it when we have time, is the government of California, with its fixation on green energy and combating climate change. It's also a model for where we will go in the future if the Democrat Party has its way and wants to make climate change the, the big existential threat against which we are protecting.
Because right, because that is the big threat, right?
In California.
Yeah.
The big threat. That's the big threat. And unfortunately, I think that they're not, they're just not realizing what the big threat is. But I do think that people who live in cities who realized that they do have some services, but they can't go to work because their businesses are not open, and so they're not going to get paychecks. I mean, there's a whole lot of fallout from this PG&E shutdown. All righty, so we will chat about that, I am sure. There we go. We're experimenting with the new music thing. I have my finger on the button. For the first time in 10 years, my finger is on the button.
I'm scared.
We'll be right back. Our guest is Dr. Peter Pry, and you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them? What do they want? What should we do about them?
Another runner in the night, blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche. Another runner in the night.
And we're back. You're listening to We the People Radio. We're here with our guest, Dr. Peter Pry, and we're talking about the situation with California and the power outages and how that relates to our national power grid and the implications for national security. So, most specifically, I guess, what would you say to people that are whose, you know, hair is on fire about this whole thing and they really want to do something? Is there anything for the public to do at this point?
Oh, sure. There's a lot that the public can do. For one thing, you know, they can, I would encourage people to write to President Trump or send him emails or Twitter or however people communicate on these matters these days and thank him for signing on March 26th of this year his executive order on EMP to protect our national electric grid from EMP. And it basically is an excellent executive order intended to implement the recommendations of the EMP Commission, the recommendations that scientists and intelligence officers and strategists have been trying to get in place to protect our nation for 20 years, and President Trump finally signed that executive order. But at the same time, I would ask him in these communications to please also follow the EMP Commission recommendations, in terms of how it is to be implemented, because no executive order. An executive order is only as good as those who are going to be implementing it. And unfortunately, sure, just like with so many of President Trump's plans, like building the wall, you know, he's encountering, he probably is not even aware of the resistance that's coming from the deep state, the business-as-usual attitudes. His National Security Council staff, and we all know from just the recent history that his NSC staff has a lot of untrustworthy people working for it who are not loyal to the president and are not interested in advancing the president's agenda, on whether it's on Ukraine or other issues, trying to undermine him. But somehow the National Security Council staff got the idea in its head that it would be a good idea to have President Trump's EMP executive order implemented by people, bureaucrats who are working on the Department of Energy and the Department of Homeland Security, people who are Obama holdovers, people who are members of the deep state, who have spent their professional careers obstructing national EMP preparedness, saying EMP isn't that big of a threat, saying that the risk of an EMP is so low that we should give it very low priority or ignore it completely. How do it doesn't make sense.
I don't really understand that, and I've never
had an attitude in their whole in their professional lives who worked in the Obama administration, for example, are going to give the enthusiasm and energy and honesty that's necessary to implement the president's EMP executive order. And that's exactly, you know, what's happening. We've got an excellent executive order, but it's being slow-rolled and sabotaged by implementation by people who don't believe in the executive order.
Why? What's the big mystery with EMP?
What I'm suggesting, because you said what's one of the things the grassroots can do, people listening to the show can write to the president, they should write to their senators, write to their congressmen, and praise the president for the EMP executive order, but beg him to put different people in charge of its implementation, real experts, people who understand the EMP threat.
That makes sense. Why? The thing that has never made any sense to me, though, is why anybody would say that EMP or power grid failure of any kind, whether it's something from the sun or it's a cyber, cyber warfare, maybe cuts it off, or tons of different reasons. But why would they think that's just never going to happen?
Well, you don't understand the reason for that. Okay, well, that's because you live in California, probably a part of California, where people have common sense and logic tends to prevail.
The last stronghold.
You know, you have to live and have worked inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C., you know, to understand how these things happen. For example, let's use a different analogy, take a different case. You know, who would imagine that the federal regulatory agencies and their relationship with the airlines, after years of regulatory effort and thinking of through different threat scenarios, you know, would have resisted putting a lock that costs about $1.50 on the door in an airliner, okay, to prevent terrorists from getting access to the cabin so that they could take over the airplanes and then fly them into skyscrapers and kill 30,000 Americans. One would think that such a thing would be impossible. It's just such common sense to do that, you know, but they didn't do it, okay? Or, you know, that's one example of how the people's business doesn't get done in Washington. On even very basic common sense national security kinds of things. And there's reasons for this, there are several reasons for it. One reason is there's a personality type that works in Washington, your typical deep stater. People don't get fired for making mistakes. Do you know nobody got fired from the intelligence community or from any of those federal or regulatory agencies who screwed up and created the conditions that enabled the terrorists to kill 3,000 Americans? Nobody got fired. In fact, the people responsible for that actually got promoted, even after such a disaster. And so when you constantly get promoted and you can't get fired, you know, there's a phenomenon in human nature. You always want to believe that you deserve the money you get, the plaudits you get for the high-ranking position you may have as an official in DHS or DOE, that you're right about these things. Okay, even though you've screwed up, you know, you never get punished for it, and so you don't really think it's a screw-up. So there's that personality type. You call that inertia, bureaucratic inertia. We know what we're doing. We've always done it this way. We're going to keep doing it. We know what's important. I never heard of EMP. I never heard of cyber warfare. I never heard of somebody taking a rifle and shooting at a transformer. These are weird things that I've never heard of before. And it's not what I want to focus on. I want to do what I was doing yesterday. You know, that's the easiest thing for me. It requires the least energy and the least effort. These other problems force me to think creatively, and I don't want to do that. Besides, I don't have to because I'm the smartest guy in the room. You know, I've gotten all these promotions. I've been here for years. So bureaucratic inertia, that's one problem. Another problem is dishonesty and greed. You know, the regulatory agencies, like, take a look at the commissioners on the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. You know, there's nine of them. These nine people are basically responsible for the security of the U.S. electric grid. And if you look into their backgrounds, every single one of them is a lawyer or a lobbyist who has worked for the electric power industry, and they have come from the electric power industry. And when they're done as commissioners, they're going to go back working for the electric power industry. In political science, I think the phrase is regulatory capture. When you are able to infiltrate your own people, you know, into a regulatory agency, you basically take it over. And so that's why the U.S. FERC basically never does anything and has ignored the EMP Commission recommendations. You know, if the U.S. FERC had listened to the EMP Commission reports, Dr. Graham and I went in and we briefed the U.S. FERC. They never did anything. That's why the president had to write an EMP executive order to kick butt in the U.S. government to get them to do something. So that's another problem, you know, greed and corruption, you know, which is why they haven't done anything, because of this rotating door. And then I guess the last big factor is ideology. You know, you have a lot of Obama holdovers. The Obama administration was, you know, very radical in its views toward things. And EMP was a politically incorrect threat under the Obama administration. And why is that? Because the Obama had two big foreign policy goals. You know, one of them was a world without nuclear weapons. You know, the Obama administration wanted to convince itself that through a process, if the United States did not modernize its nuclear forces and through a process of negotiation, you know, we could lead by example and convince other countries to give up nuclear weapons, including countries like North Korea or Iran, who had nascent nuclear weapon programs. And part of this narrative, crucial to this narrative, was the idea that a small or even one nuclear weapon, a small nuclear weapon program, doesn't buy you much, that you can't do much with that, that in order to compete with the United States or pose a significant threat to the United States, you would have to build, you know, hundreds of nuclear weapons and have a sophisticated nuclear arsenal like that of the United States. And so since they'd never be able to catch up with us, it just makes sense that from their point of view, that it's realistic to achieve, that you could realistically achieve a world without nuclear weapons by the U.S. leading by example and through endless negotiations. But EMP kicks that narrative into a cocked hat because you only need one nuclear weapon to bring a nation like the United States to its knees with an EMP attack. And therefore, a single Iranian nuclear weapon or a single North Korean nuclear weapon poses an existential threat to us. And they would have every reason to want to acquire that, despite the disparity in the numbers. The other part of the problem, you know, from the Obama administration point of view, from an ideological point of view, was the other big goal they had was the Joint Conference of Plan of Action, or the Iran nuclear deal. And it had that same argument there, that even though Iran, according to their own estimates, was a year away from the bomb, only 1 year away at most, that didn't matter much because they would still only be able to acquire a small number of nuclear weapons. And that wouldn't pose much of a threat to us.
But small, you know, and nuclear in the same sentence can't cancel each other out there. We have to take a really quick break, and we're going to come back. Let's stick on that Iran nuclear deal, because there were lots of things wrong with that. And I think we have a huge segment of our population that didn't understand it and doesn't understand why it was a problem. You are listening to We the People. We will be right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Pry. our guest, Dr. Peter Pry. Okay, so back to Iran. Because that really seemed like a bad plan. But there were just a lot of people, and still are, that thought that was going to solve everything.
Yes. Before we go to Iran.
Oh, okay.
If I could. I apologize for taking up the whole of the last segment with my response. But you
did
ask an excellent question about why hasn't Washington done anything about this.
Right.
And I thought it deserved a comprehensive answer. And my response was that, there are multiple reasons why inside the Beltway Washington is unable to deal with threats like EMP, and they include bureaucratic inertia and corruption and ideology. And an additional important ideological factor in the Obama administration, particularly, that made EMP a politically incorrect threat, is they didn't want EMP competing with climate change as the big existential threat to the United States, especially because the solutions to EMP go so contrary to the green energy agenda. You know, the EMP Commission assessment finds that sources of electricity like hydropower and nuclear and coal, which are the sources of most of our electricity, and natural gas, you know, these carbon-based and nuclear isn't carbon-based, but coal and natural gas are, that these are the most resilient forms of energy to EMP and cyber attack, and therefore we should encourage them. This is sort of thing should be proliferated and grown and not limited and restricted.
What about hydro? Because we have so much hydro here in Northern California.
I started with hydro. Hydro is number one in terms of being your most resilient and best form of energy from a national security standpoint.
But they just hate it because it puts a dam in a river, and then we get back to it's all about the fish, which it never is.
And the green energy guys want to get rid of all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so EMP didn't fit into that part of the agenda. Going back to Iran, and what a terrible deal that was. I've written extensively about this, and I wrote one particular essay, called Iran, the worst deal, because you can't have a worse deal than a deal that seeks to prevent something from happening, which has actually already happened. Because in my view, and this is a view that doesn't get an airing on the mainstream media. And I'm so disappointed that even the House Republicans have never had a hearing on it. But Iran probably already has nuclear weapons and missiles to deliver them, and it probably had that capability years before Obama inked the Joint Conference of Plan of Action, the so-called Iran nuclear deal. Years before that, and I'm not alone in this view. Some of our nation's foremost intelligence and technological experts have co-authored articles with me and spoken on this, including my old boss, Dr. Graham, who was President Reagan's White House science advisor, and he ran NASA, and he was chairman of the EMP Commission, and Jim Woolsey, who was the former CIA director, and Fritz Ehrmarth, who was the chairman of the National Intelligence Council under Ronald Reagan, and Ambassador Henry Cooper, who was the director of the Strategic Defense Initiative. And I know that this view is also shared by most Israeli intelligence officials, that Iran actually already has the bomb and has probably had the bomb for many years. And I say this because we know from the International Atomic Energy Agency reports that prior to the year 2003, before the year 2003, Iran had already conducted implosion tests, and it was building, actually manufacturing, bridge wire detonators, and it was also manufacturing neutron initiators. When the United States reached that point during the World War II Manhattan Project and had achieved those technological thresholds, we were only in a few months away from having the atomic bomb. It strains credulity to believe that Iran would have halted its nuclear weapons program in 2003 and not taken the small step forward that was necessary for weaponization and waited for President Obama to come along with his Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, it's, and yet there's never been a hearing on this alternative point of view. The mainstream media doesn't generally report on this, even though we've written quite a bit about this. And I really think that if you understand the technology of nuclear weapons, it really defies common sense to argue that, well, Iran is still a year away from the bomb. That is based on some preposterous wishful thinking, given what we know about the technological history of their nuclear weapons program.
Well, this kind of, again, gets back to our intelligence agencies. I mean, do they know this and they aren't saying, or do you think they just don't know?
I wondered if they did know about it, because, you know, the way the Obama administration behaved in the Middle East, they behaved as if they knew that Iran had the bomb, because they were doing everything they could to bend over backwards to make nice with Iran suddenly. And they were also distancing themselves from our traditional allies in the Middle East, like Israel and the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. Everything we could to try to keep the Iranians happy, and also that would account for the Obama administration wanting to pull us more and more out of the Middle East, which I think we should be doing. I mean, President Trump wants to do that too, but Obama seemed to be contradicted by his idea that, well, we're going to be tough on Iran and stop them from getting the bomb. But he was acting as if they already had it. And he did similar things with North Korea, too. We now know that North Korea had the bomb during Obama's watch. He never admitted it. He didn't want to admit it because he didn't want to take responsibility for North Korea having achieved nuclear missile capabilities that could reach the United States on his watch. And I suspect a similar rationale applied to Iran, that he didn't want to have that big black mark against the history of his administration. So it's possible that they knew, but they've just never wanted to admit it and don't want to admit it today. Just because President Trump is president, by the way, people need to understand President Trump's intelligence community is not his intelligence community.
No.
It's President Obama's intelligence community. You know, he made the huge mistake of making Dan Coats, he's now fired Dan Coats, fortunately. I wrote a series of articles urging him to do that. I don't know if you read any of them, but maybe he just got fed up. But Dan Coats, who I always respected when he was a senator, you know, a conservative senator, he was great at that. But it's a huge mistake to take a long-serving senator and then put them in charge of something like the intelligence community, you know, because they're not intellectually equipped to do battle with the intelligence community and support the president's view. And, you know, Coats went in there and he didn't fire anybody. You know, he basically had the same staff from Obama and he got captured by them.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, the intelligence community view of the world is Obama's view of the world. They think climate change is an existential threat. They think we should stay in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. They think we should stay in Syria. You know, I mean, they have all of the Obama administration points of view on all of these threats. They never mention EMP as a threat, you know? President Trump, 3 years into his administration, is not stuck. The buck does stop at the president's office on this. You know, and that's one thing, even though I'm an admirer of President Trump and I support him, I do not understand why he doesn't say, you're fired. It's one of the reasons.
I know, and he's really good at that. We thought he'd do a lot of that.
Yeah, he's done it a lot of it among very high-ranking people in the White House. And on occasion, he'll knock off. He did finally get rid of Dan Coats. And he got rid of that incompetent woman who was running the Department of Homeland Security, finally. Okay? But you've got to do more than that. Whenever an administration comes in, you know, the Democrats don't hesitate to replace all the top tier, the senior executive service, but hundreds of people go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they tender their resignations are accepted, then you bring in your own people. I think, you know, President Trump didn't do that. And so I think he had the mistake because he'd never held an office in Washington.
Yeah, I was curious about that.
But don't you have to drill down? I mean, the top people, absolutely, you need to change and get your own folks in there. But below them is the worker bees. Those are the ones that are, I
grinding
think, at this
away
point,
the policy.
Yeah, really doing all the damage.
Absolutely. And they're given the opportunity to do the damage because you haven't replaced the top guys. Look at that colonel that just testified against President Trump trying to get him impeached. What's he doing in the National Security Council staff? Obviously, you know, he's been rotated there, you know, from the intelligence community to be in that position, probably to do exactly that. Now, if you had your own people in charge, you know, you would start exiling people like that to Siberia. You might not be able to fire them because of the government rules, but at least you could put them in charge of food service in the cafeteria or something.
Right.
And
you'd have somebody who would know that Brennan's mole was on your phone call.
Yeah, right, exactly. And then put your own people, trustworthy people, in. The Democrats always consistently do that. The Republicans always, Bush made the same mistake. You know, Bush tried to go along and get along with the Clinton administration appointees. And you know, Republicans always want, it seems, to be gentlemanly about it and make everything bipartisan and think that if they let these people keep their jobs and that they'll be loyal. And that never works out.
And they'll see the light.
Trump had the idea that that these intelligence community so-called professionals, okay, that being a professional in the intelligence community, the State Department, is the same thing as being a professional in the private sector, like a lawyer, you know? I mean, a lawyer, you can pay him, he'll argue both sides of an argument. Whatever side of the argument you pay him to argue, he'll do it with equal, you know, competence and vigor. But ideology doesn't figure into most of these things in the private sector the way it does in Washington.
Right.
And it's very, these people are professional ideologues for the most part. You know, they're good at advancing an agenda that they have in mind, you know.
And we've kind of seen what not taking that to heart has severe consequences. We're going to take a really quick break. We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Pry. You are listening to We the People Radio. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
It's electric.
Dark and you want to see, you need a
electricity.
Flip that switch and what do you get? You get a
electricity.
Every room can now be lit with just a
electricity.
Where do you think it all comes from? This powerful
electricity.
That was from Schoolhouse Rock. That's where we should have learned all of that, was way back when we were kids. But for some reason, we're doing a lot of remedial work now as adults. Okay, so we've got you as our hostage for the next hour, Dr. Pry. So how would you like to close out this hour?
Well, as a comment, we were just talking about the corruption of the intelligence community.
Right.
And I think... here's a litmus test I have that everybody can use, even people who are not experts in the intelligence community, to see whether the intelligence community is reformed or not to be supportive of President Trump. And you may recall that during the transition, before President Trump was sworn in, the Obama administration intelligence community had put out an unclassified national intelligence estimate, which is very rare, by the way. You know, usually national intelligence estimates are deeply classified. They're not often put out unclassified, but they put this one out in a big hurry. And you might recall that national intelligence estimate said basically that the Russians got President Trump elected because of collusion with the Russians, or at least that the Russians basically wanted Trump elected over Hillary, and they did all kinds of things that helped him get elected. And it struck at the legitimacy of President Trump's election, and was the basis for the launching of the Mueller investigation, you know, which the Democrats hoped would become their basis for impeaching him. To this day, 3 years into the Trump administration, those national intelligence estimates are still there. They've not been recalled. When Dan Coats, I mean, that's one of the things that made me so angry, at Dan Coats being the director of national intelligence. The first thing he should have done when he came in as the director of national intelligence is recalled those reports. You know, he should have said that, look, the author of these reports, you know, General Clapper, General Brennan, the FBI under Comey, they're so partisan and anti-Trump that intelligence community was so politicized that these national intelligence estimates shouldn't be regarded as credible. And he should have recalled those reports and trash-canned them. At minimum, he should have launched a B-team investigation to say, wait a minute, we're suspending these reports and recalling them so that we can re-examine all the evidence and see if these national intelligence estimates deserve to be out there. But that hasn't happened. You know, those national and I'm amazed that President Trump has tolerated it, that those NIEs are still out there.
What do you think?
Things are going to come back and haunt him in the election, in the 2020 elections. Do you think the Democrats are not going to say, look, President Trump's own intelligence community had 4 years to recall these national intelligence estimates, and they didn't do it? You know, even his own intelligence community agrees that there was hanky-panky going on and corruption, and that his presidency is due to Russian interference in our elections. I mean, that is just so obvious to me that they will do that. But that's a litmus test to look for. Will we ever get a Trump director of national intelligence who will tear those reports up and recall them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think that's just another case of, well, hey, that's what our experts say, we got to go with it, rather than, like you say, get a B team in there and figure out what's really going on? Because at this point, I don't see how he can trust anything that comes out of our national intelligence agencies with all the holdovers. I don't know that he's going to get the true story on much, because they've made it very clear they don't like him.
I agree. And what you said is exactly what happened with Dan Coats. Dan Coats is on the record. I mean, I think he was in some event in Colorado, and he was asked about those national intelligence estimates. And he said something to the effect of what you just said. Well, our intelligence professionals made that judgment, and I have to stand by it.
Yeah.
He should have been fired immediately. But no, you know, President Trump let him stay on. I mean, this man has such patience and loyalty, but it never seems to be reciprocated, you know, or rarely.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. No, I don't know. I don't know how he operates with so many people in the lower levels of his administration that are just fighting him tooth and nail on everything he says, everything he does. I mean, he's getting a lot done. I mean, he's appointing judges, and, you know, he's doing a lot of good things. But I don't think people realize how much we could really get done if he had a team of people behind him carrying out his wishes. I just think we would do amazing things.
Well, and on this particular topic of our electric grid, I don't understand how those people all have friends, neighbors, relatives, and some of them live in other parts of the country. If everything goes down the drain, you'd think that just a decent sense of self-preservation would get him in the game on this particular topic. This isn't really a left-right issue. Well, it is, I guess, if you look at the green power thing.
Yeah, it shouldn't be, but we have become such a polarized society that almost everything is a left-right issue, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah.
You think they honestly believe that if they're, you know, like the thing in California, if only we had, you know, solar and more wind. You know, I got to tell you, the day that the wind was blowing up a rip, it was the first time that they had shut the power off. I was driving up Interstate 5, and I look over, and there's a windmill that's, I don't know, 7,000 feet tall at the Walmart distribution center, and that thing is usually turning. Here's the day with free wind for everyone, and it's not moving an inch.
Well, these, ironically, the solutions that the green energy agenda has will actually make our vulnerability worse. Over the summer, for example, we could also see our future, if they have their way, looking to what happened in the United Kingdom, in England. There was a massive nationwide blackout in Britain, not caused by an EMP or cyber attack, but it was caused because England has been building windmills. And the grid, the grid was never designed to accommodate, you know, these alternative sources of energy feeding in. And so it makes, it adds another layer of technological complexity to a system that's already technologically complex and increases more pathways for failure. And that's exactly what happened. There were a couple of wind glitches in a couple of the windmills, and it basically caught, it tripped a couple, some of the major generators and put all of Britain into blackout for about 12 hours. And, the normally staid British people were having to go to the bathroom out of train windows because there were hundreds of thousands of people stranded all over the country in electric trains, you know, that couldn't get home. Elevators wouldn't work. All the usual crises, you know, all kinds of emergency problems. And that's our future.
Sure.
If we go forward with the green craziness. Not only don't those things really work as a practical means of energy, but they make the existing grid more vulnerable to failure. And, of course, they will make it more vulnerable to attack, too, because those pathways, those additional pathways, can be exploited by the enemy to bring down our national grid and kill potentially millions of people.
Yeah. Well, our fixation with electric cars, that takes all the fun out of it when you can't charge the thing. I mean, you have some of these cars that are 100% electric, so you've got to go spend hours sitting at some random location. I guess you have to pay for the parking space, too.
Where does the electricity come from?
Yeah, well, that's the funny part. They think they just go park there and it's all good.
It has to be manufactured in some way.
Right.
And then what do you do with those batteries? Talk about environmental problems. Eventually, those batteries have to be replaced and disposed of.
Right.
And, it's not quite as bad as trying to get rid of nuclear waste, okay? But trying to find a place to safely dispose of a lithium battery is a serious problem. Those things are potentially like bombs that you've got to get rid of. But you had asked the original question, excellent question, do I think these people really believe this? AOC, for example,
We are unfortunately in the last, 20 seconds here of our final minutes here with you. And we'll come back in the next hour.
And we'll pick this right back up again.
It's like we
Lots
were never gone.
About.
Join us. We're at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. They were formerly Team Power. You might recognize that name. They've been around for a long time. They sold to Pape and became bigger and better. So go by and see them if you're looking for tractors, lawn equipment, and they're also a Honda dealer. They handle the Honda generators, so us here in California all need generators now. So
yes, we seem to.
Yep, come by and see them, and they've got a full line of generators to choose from. And their phone number is 226-9226, or you can get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Bonus.
Yeah.
Look at that. Went off like you planned it. And don't wait till the power goes out before you get your generator, because things get a little squirrely then.
Yeah.
Our guest today is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He's the Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and Director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. Both are congressional advisory boards, and he's served on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, darn it, I was doing so well, and the House Armed Services Committee, along with the CIA. He's the author of Apocalypse Unknown, The Struggle to Protect America from Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe, and something we've experienced here in California, just in small version, electric Armageddon. So we're discussing grid issues and how California is very much the example of what you could be doing if you don't live in California. The article we've posted today at WeThePeopleRadio.us is California Wildfires, Object Lesson for National Grid Security, and Dr. Pry co-authored that with some super smart guys, Dr. William Graham, who served as the chairman of the Congressional EMP Commission. He was President Reagan's science advisor. He ran the NSA, and he was on the defense science team that discovered the EMP phenomenon and developed protective measures. Ambassador James Woolsey, director of the Central Intelligence Agency. So, had some smart folks work on this article. And, you know, Dr. Pry, the one thing that strikes me about the article is, with all three of you working on it, how short it is.
Well, there's a word limit when it comes to those. You can't exceed 850 words.
I was like, I bet you guys had to fight bitterly about that.
Well, we actually didn't have to. We're so like-minded on these matters. Earlier in the show, in the last hour, you had asked me, what can people do?
Yes.
You know, I had suggested people writing and praising President Trump for the for his EMP Commission executive order that he wrote. But there's another thing people can do, because we don't have to. I've been hearing, you know, your advertisement for people to go out and buy generators and things of that sort, which they should do. You know, people shouldn't trust the federal government to be able to come to the rescue. We talked about the last hour about how President Trump's EMP executive order is being undermined by the deep state. You know, you can protect yourself, get a generator, have food, water, basically do the things. This kind of preparation is derided as survivalism today. But you know, my father's generation, the great generation that lived through the Great Depression and survived World War II, whether you were Republican or a Democrat, if you came out of that generation, you would be what today we would call a survivalist.
Mm-hmm.
Where I grew up, you know, on a quarter acre in upstate New York, you know, my mother had a garden. She was constantly canning food. My father taught us how to hunt and fish, not just for recreation, because that's how he fed his family during the Great Depression. And they had never heard of EMP, but they were expecting that someday there might be a nuclear war, there might be another economic crisis, the federal government might screw up in some massive way again and bring on a Great Depression, but that every family had to be their own first line of defense. And that's not crazy. Those are traditional American values.
Yep.
That great generation, they were sort of the last of the pioneer stock that believed in rugged individualism and self-sufficiency, which is what made America great and possible. The Constitution, written by the founders, was written for people like that, you know, people that were jealous of their freedoms and didn't want a handout from government, you know, that realized that government could actually threaten your security. And so you'd be constantly watching government like a hawk, and at the same time being prepared yourself to take care of your family. And so I think what you are doing just by your advertisements on this show is a positive contribution, you know, to public safety. Another thing people could do, in addition to being able to take care of themselves, which would enable you also to take care of your neighbors, which is a Christian thing to do,
mm-hmm.
but another thing one could do, you know, my book Blackout Wars, okay, you know, is actually one of my more popular books. And, you know, that's available on Amazon.com. You don't have to protect the whole country. An individual state can protect itself if you're willing to do the right thing and harden the generators, harden the EHV transformers. If you're protected against a worst-case scenario like EMP, it'll also protect you against all the lesser threats like cyber warfare, EMP from the sun, non-nuclear EMP weapons, and severe weather, you know, like hurricanes, tornadoes, the high winds that you're having in California now. You'd be able to recover the grid much more quickly, and it would be much less susceptible to failure. Now, it's probably a bridge too far because your government in California, it may seem a bridge too far because the government in California is so left-wing and democratic, but, you know, California actually has passed some legislation, you know, that is pro EMP preparedness. So there might be something to build on there. And the book describes how you can take legislative initiatives. It describes legislative initiatives at the state level that were advanced, in most cases successfully, in some cases unsuccessfully. And it provides a series of case studies that, people in California or other states, you know, might be able to pursue in their state to not wait for the Washington to come to the rescue and protect the national grid, but at least get the grid in your state or your community protected. You can do that and be an island of survivability. You don't and shouldn't have to be dependent on Washington or Sacramento if the government in the state is unwilling to take action.
Well, you know, it's sad, but you see more and more people, you know, as a society, I think we've become so dependent on someone else to take care of our needs. We aren't self-sufficient anymore. We don't know how to grow a garden. We don't know how to do a lot of these things that you were just talking about. And I think people really need to get back to that. I mean, we saw it with this blackout. The power goes out, and everybody's in a big panic, and they want to run out and buy a generator. Well, guess what? Nobody has a generator now because everybody's
they're
sold.
All gone.
They're all gone.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden, whose fault is it? You know, I can't run my refrigerator. I can't. You know, you got to plan. You got to become a little more self-sufficient and stop depending on somebody else to take care of you.
And last night, we actually learned that apparently in California, they were replacing all the food stamps. So if you're thinking this isn't affecting you, like in the city of Reading, to give them credit, city of Reading is taking good care of their infrastructure and their power didn't go out. So if you were served by the city of Reading, Reading Electric Utility, you were good to go. And it was interesting. I noticed that we had so many, we have 90,000 people in our town. So it's big.
Fairly small
it's
town.
Big for here, but it's small in the scope of things. And we had so much traffic. I thought, what is going on? Why do we have so many cars? And I always kind of laugh at myself because people, a lot of those people who grew up here and never lived in a city, they're like, look at all the traffic. I'm like, you should get out more.
Run down to LA and see traffic.
But there actually was a ton of traffic. So I think that people were coming in from the outlying areas who didn't have power, maybe staying with friends, that kind of thing. So it puts a tremendous strain on the town here. But honestly, you look at all of it and you've got a myriad of things that have hit everyone. People out of work for periods of time because the business they work for didn't have power. They are replacing all the food stamps. So if they went out, I was talking to a girl at the grocery store last night. She said if people spent their food stamps and then the power went out for a week, they replaced them again right after the power outage because they assumed they lost all that food. So in a lot of cases, people, you know, got double the food stamps. So regardless of how you feel about that whole issue,
you're paid for it if you're a taxpayer. The gasoline for your car. Why do you wait until your car's on empty to go to the gas station?
And then
the pumps are electric. You can't get gas. So
we've got to take a really quick break. We're going to come back and sorry, that's all the talking we'll do. We'll let Dr. Pry come back and run things for us. We figured a little AC/DC and some high voltage would make you feel happier this afternoon. We're back with our guest, Dr. Peter Pry. Okay, where should we go now? Besides the fact all the green stuff doesn't really work. Is there anything we've left out on that? Or it does work, but it's not going to solve our problem. How's that?
That's right. It can actually make our problems worse, the wind power and the solar power that they're talking about. You know, no substitute for the big grid. Although I am certainly not against, and there are technologies under development. The ideal thing, in my view, would be to be able to eventually replace the big grid. You know, you're not going to be able to do that with wind. But there are technologies in train. I can't get into discussing them in detail because I've signed non-disclosure agreements. But imagine a technology, an electrical technology. Think of it as a super battery, you know, so that you could actually run a car and never have to recharge it, or could go decades without having to recharge it, or a battery that would come for your house and would be sold right along with your house, and it would provide all the electricity, so you'd never have to be tied into the big grid. That would be an ideal solution a lot of the national security threats, cyber, EMP, that we're talking about. And it would also be a solution to the societal problem we've been discussing, I think, or at least a step in the right direction. You know, the pioneer stock we were talking about, they didn't have the big grid. They were self-sufficient. You know, they relied on the fuel, wood, you know, to heat their homes and do everything around. Families could be self-contained, you know, growing their own food. Something like that would start restoring, the society that we've lost, you know, where you wouldn't have to be so dependent on a big corporation and on the regulatory agencies of big government. A comment that was made earlier was how people have lost the ability to be far-sighted. They don't think about making basic things like making sure you've got a full tank of gas, let alone being prepared for water shortages and food shortages.
Exactly.
We seem to have lost in a single generation those qualities that the great generation had of rugged individualism and self-sufficiency and foresight, forethought, you know, thinking through, well, what do I really need? The idea that I might be, and people are getting an attitude increasingly that they want to be taken care of by the government. I find it so dismaying that so many young people, if these polls are telling the truth, you know, so many young people embrace socialism and are followers of Bernie Sanders, and they want a socialist society. And they obviously have learned nothing from history, you know, or even from current affairs. If you look at Venezuela, all socialist experiments have failed. You know, there are myths out there, like Sweden is supposed to be a socialist country. It's not a socialist country. The Swedes would reject that. You know, this goes beyond national security issues, and pertains to the kind of people we are, we used to be, and what we are becoming. And that's very disturbing. I don't think it's an accident that this appearance of these Republican, call it Republic with a small r, what the founders used to call Republican virtues, okay? That's what the great generation had. They had Republican virtues. You know, they were jealous of their freedoms. They were distrustful of government. They took a pride in being able to take care of themselves and their families. And with the disappearance of those Republican virtues, people are turning towards socialism and are willing to make the trade that Benjamin Franklin warned against. You know, tyranny always promises security, but those who are foolish enough to believe it, you know, and would trade their freedoms for security, they end up deserving neither. They end up deserving neither freedom or security, and they get neither in the end of the day. They get neither.
Mm-hmm. We have so many things that you think about that one statement, a government big enough to give you everything, it's big enough to take it all away.
Yep. No, I can remember when, you went out and got a good job, and if you couldn't get a job in the private sector, you could fall back on going to work for the government. But that really wasn't the answer. People didn't want to work for the government. Now it's absolutely reversed, where people want those government jobs because they're secure and they, you know, they're going
to
provide
everything.
Well,
and they didn't used to pay an industry standard.
Right.
Either.
No.
And now they're actually paying over industry standard because,
yes.
you know, we have an unlimited checkbook. So,
yeah, go to work.
That's
for the
kind
government.
Of skewed things as well. But honestly, I don't know that people are realizing how much money, like in California, for instance, it's like $2.5 billion that's being spent on green energy, whatchamacallit, instead of maintenance of the PG&E lines. So when people start looking at this, they think, oh, well, we just need to get a better company to come in. Well, hello, we could get the greatest company in the universe to come in and take it over. But if they do, they've got the same infrastructure and they have the same requirements on their spending. There's a bill that's been co-authored by Assemblyman James Gallagher and Senator Jim Nielsen in the California legislature to set aside the green mandate and let PG&E use their money to work on the grid to get this up and running and to deal with their tree trimming. And I know Congressman LaMalfa has actually had to write a bill to say that it shouldn't take 6 years to be able to trim trees underneath power lines. So it's sped up that process. So somehow we've had to, you know, we're passing all this legislation to do things that I think most people would, I mean, they think that it can be done now. And it can.
Yeah, I don't
right.
think a lot of people have realized that the government has actually tied the hands in some ways of PG&E to spend their money on
yeah.
this crazy stuff.
And before we
stuff.
Throw the word government around too much, I mean, a lot of that was done by people that citizens of California elected.
Yes.
So, you know, might want to check out who you're voting for when it comes time for that, because a lot of those folks were into that plan, and
right.
you have nobody to blame but the folks you elected.
And I'm not saying PG&E wasn't at fault.
No.
I mean, they've done a terrible job of maintaining their side of the deal, but they do at this point. We better do something to get it back up and running and in good shape, or this is going to be a kind of a glimpse of things to come in the future, and it's going to get worse. So,
right. Basically, what you've got in California now, where the grid is concerned, is socialism. And the government and PG&E can share the blame equally. I know that your Governor Newsom was trying to blame PG&E exclusively.
Yeah,
which
that
was just
work.
Rich.
In our article, and shift the blame onto him. But this is not true. It isn't all PG&E's fault. It's at least half government's fault. And not just in California either, but federal government's fault as
mm-hmm.
well. You know, years ago, there was a report delivered to the California Public Utilities Commission warning about these very problems. The Democrats have been in charge all this time. They didn't do anything. They didn't do anything to require PG&E through the regulatory process to protect itself. And up in Washington, the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the NERC, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, who are supposed to partner, NERC is private, the U.S. FERC is the federal government, they're supposed to private on national grid security, including the grid security in California. All this stuff has happened on their watch, under their noses. You know, so, you know, this is socialism in action when it comes to the electric grid,
mm-hmm.
where these guys have not been, you know, the combination of corporate interests and government interests have conspired to create a disaster, which is unfolding in front of our eyes in California. And, you know, and this is... You know, why these guys can't be trusted to protect us against more. And these institutional arrangements have to be changed if we expect to be secure against bigger threats like EMP and cyber warfare.
Well, see, and up here at the northern end of the state and at the southern end of Oregon, there are 4 hydroelectric dams that they are just salivating to remove. It provides electricity for some 77,000 homes, maybe, but it's a huge hedge against flood. Provides some not gigantic, but reservoirs that provide water for firefighting. There are all sorts of things that go on when we have dammed up these rivers, and they talk about just the miles and miles of river that the fish would get, although the fish were not up there years ago. So they have this back to nature philosophy where they convince everybody we're doing restoration. Well, restoration would mean we go back to where we were, but that river never was like what they think it's going to be like now. And they're planning on leaving all the cement from the dams in the river, which I'm not sure exactly how they get away with that. But there goes more hydroelectric. And they're coming after the bigger and bigger and bigger dams. There's a gigantic movement in this country to take out dams, and most specifically hydro dams, which will just cripple us. It's crazy.
Yeah, that'll be an enormous mistake. They're the single most resilient part of our electric grid against all the threats we've been discussing, and they provide an enormous amount of our electricity.
People here are so aware of that. The county north of us, they all made buttons that says, "I'm a dam hugger." So if you go up there, you know, you see buttons and bumper stickers that say, "I'm a dam hugger." And I'm sure people who drive through are thinking, what? But maybe that'll catch on because hydro is so much better than so many of these other things. And yet, interestingly, in California, PG&E isn't allowed to count the Shasta Dam, which is enormous, and I can't give you all the numbers because it's just not my deal. But it's a huge dam, provides lots of hydropower, but not to its capacity by any stretch, and is not considered part of the PG&E green portfolio because Southern California Edison doesn't have any hydro, so that wouldn't be fair. So they're not allowed to count it. They have to spend a bunch of money on solar and wind credits to offset the hydro that they're
again,
using.
Again, mandating them to spend money on green energy when they have.
Yeah. So before people think it's one thing, it's more than one thing. I hate to say it. So really quick break. We'll be back with our guest, Dr. Peter Pry. You are listening to We the People Radio. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Joel song that I hadn't heard in a long time, and the rest of the song, it's called Seeing the Lights Go Down on Broadway, and the rest of the song talks about how, you know, Harlem catches on fire, but it's always on fire, so it's no big deal. Nothing's really changed. But it kind of goes through a lot of our cities and our landmarks, and I thought, wow, I guess Dr. Pry, if you want to make your next report a musical, you should get a hold of Billy Joel. He can make make that happen for you.
I doubt I could afford it.
You could just be like us. You could just play it on the radio, and then you can play whatever you want for free. In the last half hour, what are we missing here? Are we leaving anything out? What about the whole cyber warfare thing? We haven't really talked about that. And I know we've got Professor Ayers on next week.
Yes. And
thanks to you.
She and I may disagree a little bit on this. We've discussed it a lot. There's a strange phenomena here where it seems like everybody knows about the cyber threat to the grid, and people talk about that, and the government takes it a lot more seriously than the EMP threat. And that is completely wrong-headed, you know. The cyber threat is a lot more theoretical than the EMP threat. EMP is often accused of being a theoretical Rube Goldberg kind of a threat, which is amazing, you know, because we know it's real. I mean, not only have we produced the phenomena, but we know the Russians conducted a series of high-altitude tests. In fact, they did an EMP tests over their own territory. Soviet Union was truly the evil empire. They exposed Kazakhstan in the early 60s was a heavily industrialized area, and they deliberately conducted a series of about five high-altitude EMP tests and wired up the whole area with sensors and stuff, and literally burned down and then rebuilt their electric grid and other critical infrastructures in part of the Soviet Union, which was Kazakhstan, now an independent country, so that they could test the EMP phenomena and use it in war. And, you know, that would be like setting off a bomb over, you know,
be like the song several just
U.S. states, just the Department of Defense doing that, to take down all the critical infrastructures and then rebuilding them and doing it five times, you know, to get intelligence on how effective this thing would be in wartime. And so it's been clearly demonstrated. You know, I mean, we've seen the area, the EMP field, the Soviets imposed on themselves covered an area larger than Western Europe, and it collapsed electric grids and the other critical infrastructures over that huge area. Now, it's a sparsely inhabited area. It doesn't have that many people living in it, you know, a few million people. But still, that's kind of extreme, you know.
Yeah, no kidding.
right. The kind of thing you would expect Nazi Germany to do. And the Soviet Union was no better, let's face it. But, yeah, so that's just one example. We also know that the EMP from the sun, I mean, it burns out. You know, solar storms happen every year. We know the Carrington event was real. It's not the only time there was a big geomagnetic superstorm. Fortunately, we haven't had one during the period of our electronic civilization. But we know these things will burn down and melt. There was a solar storm in 1989 called the Hydro-Quebec storm. It affected in Canada and affected the northeastern United States. This was not the Carrington event. This isn't the end of the world kind of superstorm we're concerned about, which could happen. But this storm, for example, fried a extra high voltage transformer, an EHV transformer designed to carry 750,000 volts. Okay, 750,000 volts. If you can imagine that, and it melted it in 90 seconds. And this was not a Carrington event class geomagnetic superstorm. So the threat is not theoretical. It's here. There's all kinds of empirical evidence to support it. And yet people are more worried about the cyber threat. You know, the United States has never experienced a nationwide blackout resulting from cyber. We've never had a single state knocked out by cyber. Only Ukraine has been blacked out temporarily. By Russian cyber attacks. It's possible that Turkey might have experienced a temporary blackout from Iran, and they might have been the first country to experience a cyber attack. But it isn't demonstrated. It hasn't been proven. It's theoretically possible through cyber to melt transformers and do things that would create a protracted, permanent blackout that could kill millions of people. But that's just theoretical. It hasn't actually been proven or demonstrated yet. Which is not to say that we don't need to take the cyber attack threat seriously.
Sure.
We should. As we speak, somebody could be building the atomic bomb version of a cyber virus, you know, that could do all those things, just like an EMP could. But in any case, we know the EMP threat is real, for sure. And if we're protected against that, you know, it'll also protect against the cyber and things like physical sabotage. You know, because you can also take a grid down. You don't need high-tech cyber or even EMP to inflict the kind of disaster we've been discussing. You know, there was according to the Wall Street Journal, I have to say that, according to the Wall Street Journal, there was a classified study by the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that demonstrated that if you attacked, knew which 9 EHV transformers to attack and took them out with rifle fire, you know, you could inflict a protracted blackout on the United States that would last at least 18 months, black out the whole grid, and that would kill millions of people. So that's something that is also a real thing, very doable, and yet these guys don't want to do anything. You had a great case in California, as a matter of fact, back in 2013, as I recall. In fact, it was April 16th, 2013, if I'm not mistaken. I'm pretty sure of that. That it was the attack on the Metcalf Transformer substation near San Jose, California.
Oh, that's where they shot holes in it or something?
Yeah, exactly. The electric utility, PG&E, covered that up for about 18 months and wanted to try to say, oh, it was just vandalism and nothing really happened. And that moved on one of the few occasions that the U.S. FERC did anything useful. There was a guy named John Wellinghoff who was the chairman of the U.S. FERC, and his conscience got the better of him. a rare case of somebody's conscience bothering them, and he actually resigned from his chairmanship so that he could go to the Wall Street Journal and break the story that actually this was not vandalism, but that the FERC had brought in the U.S. Navy SEALs to examine the attack, and the SEALs had judged that this was a commando exercise by a hostile foreign power to see how much they could get away with. You know, could they insert or use moles who are already in place in the United States to go in and attack that grid? They deliberately, in the judgment of the SEALs, they could have taken down that grid and put California into blackout, but they didn't want to go that far because that's not what you should do in an exercise, you know, because that would alarm your enemy and expose a vulnerability that he might then repair.
Sure. We might get our act
together. waited literally till the cops were there, you know, minutes within the time when the cops got there and within minutes of the cops arriving, they just disappeared into the night. And to this day, you know, it's 3 years later, and you know, we still don't know who did that. But an interesting coincidence was that on that very day, North Korea orbited its first satellite, the KMS-3, you know, over the Washington, D.C., New York City corridor. And the commission warns that, the EMP commission is warned that those satellites could be armed for a nuclear EMP attack. We've got 2 North Korean satellites orbiting over us now that potentially could be nuclear armed for an EMP attack. And this would fit right into this new way of warfare that the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, and the North Koreans all write about, where you use multiple axes to attack the grid, EMP, cyber, and physical sabotage. So it's just an amazing coincidence that on the same day that the KMS-3 orbited over Washington, over the eastern grid, basically, the country's divided into 3 big grids, the eastern grid, the western grid, and the Texas grid. So you had a simulated EMP attack over the eastern grid, and that very day there was a sabotage threat, you know, to the western grid. And, you know, it looked like maybe the north, and we happened to be in one of the worst, up to that point, it was one of the worst nuclear crises we were facing with the North Koreans. They had conducted another illegal nuclear test earlier in the year. And that created a crisis that was still ongoing at the time with the Obama administration.
Well, I'm sure it was just a coincidence, huh?
Right. I have to add this, too, April 16th. That very day that satellite passed over Washington, you know, Obama was telling the New York Times not to worry about North Korea, that they didn't have the means to deliver nuclear weapons against the United States yet.
Oh, my God. Huh. Well, let's mull that over for 2 minutes. We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Pry. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
When the lights go out and you throw yourself about in the dark, that's where you learn to see. When the lights go out, don't you ever doubt the light that we can really be.
Okay, I'm just thinking you don't want to be in the city by the bay when the lights go out. It's a great song, and it was really appropriate, but the more I listened, the more I thought, what the hell were they thinking when they did
that? Because that sounds like chaos to me.
Sounds like San Francisco's a bad day on a sunny day, but yeah, let's have all the lights go out and run to San Francisco. That's what I, yeah, it's on my list of things to do. All right. So interesting on the North Koreans and all the coincidences that were happening on that day.
So we're pretty certain that North Korea has the technology to deploy an EMP over the United States?
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's the assessment of the EMP commission. You know, you don't need a fancy weapon. Any nuclear weapon will create an EMP because they all have fireballs and they all put out gamma rays, you know, which is what causes the EMP effect. Mm-hmm. In fact, and it's the easiest kind of a nuclear attack to make, you know, because you don't have to be precise. You don't need a reentry vehicle that can penetrate, that has to penetrate the atmosphere. The EMP effect is so big that you can be hundreds of kilometers off target and still hit whatever it is you want.
Right.
I think a great illustration of how easy EMP is to do was the 1962 Starfish Prime high altitude test. We call it a test. You know, we didn't know about the high altitude EMP phenomena until that experiment happened. And that was because we saw the Russians doing all these high altitude tests. We didn't know why. And this was just at the end of the atmospheric testing. You know, it was our last opportunities to do a testing outside of the ground, you know, underground testing. And they basically didn't really know what was going to happen. And yet they still generated a powerful EMP, even though they just shot the thing up there a couple hundred kilometers and detonated it. It wasn't a bomb that was specially designed for EMP or anything. The field was so big, you know, it stretched out. The detonation happened over Johnston Island, the Pacific. And the field was, you know, well over 1,000 kilometers and affected the Hawaiian Islands, you know, that were on the far edge of the field. You know, sometimes the optimists, the people that don't want to do anything about EMP, say, well, yeah, civilization wasn't destroyed in the Hawaiian Islands, so, you know, why should we worry about EMP? Well, you know, the Hawaiian Islands are islands, and they're surrounded by the ocean, which tends to mitigate the EMP effects. They were also on the far edge of the detonation, where the EMP effects are weakest. And the technology of the time, you know, the early 1960s, you know, transistor and vacuum tube technologies are millions of times less vulnerable to EMP than our modern technologies, which we can test. The EMP Commission was the last organization that did a comprehensive testing regime, and we proved that, you know, our modern micro technologies, which have made our country more prosperous, and they operate faster, and they're more efficiently, and they make possible all kinds of technological miracles, are millions of times more vulnerable. It takes a lot less to knock out our society with EMP than it would have back in the 1960s. Had you detonated that same weapon that went off over Johnston Island, however, and detonated over the continental United States, it would have, despite the lower technology society we had at that time, it would have killed millions of people and put us into a protracted blackout, even with vacuum tube technologies and transistors and the like.
Right.
So this is a concern, as we bureaucrats in Washington say.
Yeah, I would think that would be the preferred mode of attack in today's society. I mean, if you really wanted to shut down a country,
exactly,
go for an EMP.
It makes you the equal. It makes you the strategic equal of the United States, because you can pose an existential threat to us with one weapon. And the bad news story actually gets worse, because we also assessed, the EMP Commission assessed, that North Korea probably does have super EMP weapons. There are weapons that are specially designed just to generate EMP. They're tuned to put out gamma rays. They don't put out a big explosion. They don't put out a lot of other kinds of effects, but they put out a lot of gamma rays. And with a very low yield gamma ray weapon, you can generate a really big EMP.
Much bigger than
the high yield weapons. You know, for example, with a nuclear weapon of conventional design, you know, a big hydrogen bomb, the biggest field you'll get would be about 50,000 volts per meter. In other words, for every meter of length on the target, you can generate 50,000 volts. So if you're driving an automobile that's, say, 4 meters long, it gets hit with 200,000 volts, 4 times 50,000 at the speed of light. But a super EMP weapon can generate 100,000, maybe 200,000 volts per meter. You know, and so 4 times greater. And the yield of the weapon can be really tiny. You know, it might be a kiloton or even less. And so that same automobile, you know, at 100,000 volts per meter, you know, would be exposed to 400,000 volts at the speed of light. And that's such a powerful field that it exceeds the EMP hardening requirements for our U.S. military forces.
Oh, terrific.
So conceivably, you could paralyze ICBMs and bombers, and people say, well, we would retaliate, wouldn't we? Well, we might not be able to retaliate because it would paralyze the retaliatory nuclear forces and the command and control systems that are designed to execute them. And you might not even know who attacked you, by the way. I mean, that's one of the other things about a satellite or a boat-launched EMP attack. You know, the first thing to go are the national technical means, the radars, the satellites that we depend upon for threat assessment to tell us, well, who attacked us? They're blinded at the speed of light, you know, so it's perfect for false flag attacks. And a president is going to have to wonder, well, wait a minute, who attacked me? I mean, there's hundreds of satellites in the same kind of orbital pathways as those North Korean satellites. How do we know it wasn't the Iranians pulling a false flag operation to try to get us to attack North Korea and start a nuclear war, you know? Or how do we know it wasn't the Chinese trying to get us to, you know, or the Iranians trying to get us into a war with Russia, the other great infidel? I mean, it would be perfect from the Iranian perspective to have the nuclear superpowers hammer on each other and eliminate themselves to clear the way for the 12th Imam.
So would it take a smaller delivery vehicle to drop one of those super EMP devices?
Yeah, these North Korean satellites are really small, you know, and but they could contain one of these super EMP weapons. They weigh less than 100 pounds.
Oh.
They resemble the design is... I can't get into too much technical detail here. But back in the Cold War, we built a warhead called the neutron bomb. It was a neutron warhead. And we built variants of that that were designed to be fired out of 155-millimeter artillery cannons, okay? So it can fit in a 155-millimeter artillery tube, the physics package. And it was designed to put out neutron radiation, you know, to kill Soviet tank crews. But it's basically what we call its official name was the enhanced radiation weapon. And the reason it's called an enhanced radiation weapon is that it created all kinds of enhanced radiation, not just neutrons. It also created enhanced gamma radiation, which is what you need for EMP.
And you could go right in and reoccupy after a neutron attack, right?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ever have a chance, I think it's in New Mexico, where they have, Sandia is in New Mexico, if I'm not mistaken, Sandia National Lab. Outside of Sandia, there's the thing called the Atomic Museum. And you can go in there, and they have displays of the mock-ups, and in some cases, the actual atomic weapons, you know, from across history, except they don't have the physics packages in it anymore.
Right.
In some cases, they've replaced that with weight, you know. And in the case of this 155-millimeter artillery shell I'm talking about, you can actually see one of them at the Atomic Museum, and you can pick it up and hold it in your hand to get an idea of the heft.
Wow.
Yeah. So these things are small. They could be delivered by anything, really. You know, you can use a weather balloon to get up above 30 kilometers and do an EMP attack that way. You could launch it off a Scud missile, off a ship, if you wanted to increase the deniability so that we wouldn't be able to figure out who attacked us. A satellite, I already mentioned that. The great thing about a satellite is that you can, you know, you can have the at altitude all the time. I mean, basically, several times a day, you know, this thing passes overhead.
Sure.
And it's sort of like, remember the old gunboat diplomacy from the 19th century? You know, when you could get what you want just by sitting, putting a battleship off of somebody's shore?
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of a situation that North Korea might have us in. You know, we've urged, I'm hoping President Trump will shoot those things down someday. You know, we've recommended that as part of
well,
the from
I think we're all going to look at all of this in a different way, and hopefully Professor Ayers just builds on this with us next week. We've got to run. We're in the last, like, 9 seconds. Thank you so much, Dr. Pry, for being with us, and we look forward to speaking with you again.
Well, thank you for having me, and give my regards to Cindy when she's on next week.
Will do. Thanks a million. You've been listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.